I'd like to call the EQB meeting to order. Thank you all for taking the time out of your busy schedules to attend. I appreciate the fact that you're here. Introductions. Let's start with Commissioner Stein on that end.
John Stein, Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
Kristen Ide-Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner.
Sandy Rummel, sitting in for Adam Dunick, Metropolitan Council.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Agriculture.
Will Seifert, Director of Environmental Quality Board.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Brian Napstead, Chairman of Bowser.
John Saxhog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
And Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Thank you. We'll jump back to the adoption of the consent agenda, which should be in your packet, and also the minutes of the September 16th meeting, which are also included in your packet.
Move approval of both.
There is a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. All those in favor say aye. Is there discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Let me just start. My week last week was spent in Guadalajara, Mexico. Somebody had to go, and I guess I was forced into it, spending time with our partners in agriculture from the various states in Mexico. And meeting with their ministers and also the various provinces of Canada and having a chance to dialogue with theirs. This is the 24th year that the three countries have met. It's called the Trinational Accord, and we were able to work through some difficult issues, things like avian influenza. We think it only hits us here in Minnesota, but you know, those birds fly all the way to Canada and all the way to Mexico. And so we dealt with that. We dealt with issues like country of origin labeling. Canada is not real happy about those issues, and so we went through a process whereby we think we may have come to some agreement as three countries. The discussion at the Trinational Accord also centered around, the issue of climate change. And we had a great opportunity this morning, thanks to the leadership of EQB, Anna Henderson and Will and other staff, to pull together a meeting of folks that are headed for Paris for the COP21 program. And I was really proud of the Environmental Quality Board and their representation today. John was there, Kate was there and presented. Kristen was there, John was there, Jim Kelly was there from the Department of Health, and Mike Rothman. Mike and John were kind of closed it up at the end of the day, or the end of the morning, or as Brian indicated, according to the brochure that went out, we were to meet from 9 until 11 p.m. And so he's all braced to go down there at 9 o'clock tonight. Kate did a wonderful presentation bringing her background and experience with the climate change discussion over the years. But I'd like to ask John and Mike to make some comments about your perception of the event this morning. And hopefully, Will, when folks that are heading for Paris that we met with today are home again. I know you indicated it today, but how important it would be to reassemble that group and to understand what happened, what took place while you were there. So, John, Mike?
Well, I just have nothing but praise and applaud the event, but the people that are going to Paris. You know, for those that weren't there this morning and then for all of us, it's a moment in history, as I said. I think that the convergence of everything that's happening right now means that it's a very significant and important time to have the event. And, You know, in the lead up to that, you know, Minnesota has had a long-standing leadership, and not only were the board members there, but we had the lieutenant governor was there, Will Steger was there, leaders in the energy and environmental community who are going to Paris, but also they're bringing youth, they're bringing young kids from McAllister College and from classrooms around. Now, it was a sad moment to hear that educators canceled plans because of the events in Paris. And what I said was that it's a terribly sad day. It's a sad day for the world, and it's a sad and awful thing that's happened. But like the people who in Paris the next morning got up and went and did the everyday routine and went back to everything, we have to stand up. We have to take this moment, and these ambassadors from Minnesota carry forth our leadership and to say we're here and we will continue to push and to stand strong to get a great outcome and success. And the stories that everybody had at the tables were phenomenal. I mean, I really do believe that. It was everybody's experience. And I just wanted to applaud everybody and just say that, you know, it's a terrific thing. I would just echo and say, just let's huddle back up and get everybody back at the table and hear their stories about what happened. And they just continue to be courageous and bold. And from my perspective, having these conversations just makes us it more urgent and responsible. We talked about it the first meeting we ever had here, that we believe we are in a position of stewardship and making these decisions for now and for generations ahead. And that's what this moment is and a lot of the things that we're doing. So but that's my thought. I thought it was terrific. Absolutely beautiful experience.
It's good. Thanks, Mike. And I just echo that. The one thing that stood out to me today is reported that, you know, October was the warmest October ever. So evidence continues to show that the climate is radically changing. And that is the only call to action we need from my chair. That and the young people that are there really embody that. They don't have the sense that waiting is an option. That was clear to me. So I was really struck by the sense of urgency in the room to take action. At the end, when Mike and I wrapped up, I challenged the group because one of the participants at the table presentations talked about the opportunity that people going to Paris have to be an eyewitness to the events. An eyewitness is when you have an accident scene, not that we want to call it global climate summit an accident, but eyewitnesses have a higher responsibility to report the details. What did you see? When did it happen? Who was involved? What are you going to bring us in a report was what I asked them. I challenged them to come back to the EQB and challenge us to do our job to analyze that information and then not be satisfied with the status quo. Minnesota has a lot of great things to say. As I walked out, you know, we are a little self-congratulatory. We've done great things on air, water, and climate, but we're nowhere near the trajectory we need to be on to achieve our goals on greenhouse gas emissions in this state. We're falling short. We can feel good about a lot of things, but we are not where we need to be. And so it is really a call to action, and I want to just leave that group, and I hope I did, with the sense of I want to hear their challenge back to us. I want them to come back and feel like they should be respectful and quiet in their opinions. They should come back and challenge us, because this is our job, to listen to people who are actively engaged, seeking the best advice and information from them, and then act on it. So that was really my takeaway. I really appreciated all of the EQB members that were there, and many of the people that on staff that are contributing their time, their professional time, but also their personal time. That's how deeply people feel about the need to act. So I was really gratified to see so many people taking time out of their calendars and their own personal finances to make this trip. That's a huge investment.
I agree, and both of you did a really nice job of wrapping up the event this morning, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Why don't we just take the opportunity to, we started this last time we met, to go around the table and let us know what's, you know, floating through your mind right now, whether it had to do this with the event this morning, Chris, or anything else that you'd want to share with us. Please do so.
Me?
You, the one.
John and I already spoke.
We already okay, so I didn't know we were all speaking.
We're going to go.
The citizen members are speaking too?
Well, actually,
okay.
Normally, no. We just
no,
kind of try and
no.
Muffle
okay.
You. You
know. Okay.
Of course you are.
Okay. Oh, I'm just completely unprepared for this, but I guess it was just very moving to be in the company today. And it's hard to think beyond that or before that because it was just such a powerful experience. So I will just say thank you. And one of the things that I think that in my unmuffled state that I might want to share from our table this morning is the youth. One of the young women at our table asked us who the indigenous delegation from Minnesota was. And I thought that was a very powerful challenge that just struck me very powerfully, and I wanted to share that with you. So.
Thank you. Sandy?
Well, I was not there.
No, but, I mean, anything. What's bouncing around in your head? What are you up to? Just an opportunity to share what's going on.
Well, I've got, vis-a-vis John's statement about we need to lower our greenhouse gases. We're not there yet. The Metro Transit just recently received an award for its 610 and Noble Parkway project as one of the most one of the most energy and sustainable parking ramps in the Twin Cities. It has a 40 kilowatt solar array, and it uses LED lighting and occupancy sensors and geothermal systems. So they're moving along on that. Metro Transit is also investigating electric buses. We're going to be putting out or applying for a grant for 5 40-foot electric buses and 2 60-foot electric buses, plus 2 en route and 2 charging stations in the garages themselves. So in environmental services, our water conservation program is getting some more funding. We're looking to get some additional funds from Clean Water Council. We've got a stormwater grant program that, again, we're going to be asking for dollars from the state. There's a lot of interest every time I go up to the Northeast metro area. They have a water summit up there. And they're willing to do the work that will. We put more water in the Mississippi. We take water, groundwater, and we use it, and then we put it in the Mississippi. And recharging our stormwater, reusing our stormwater is a big thing, but the local communities just don't have the dollars for it. So we're putting in grant money. But again, on the greenhouse gases, our 1.25 megawatt solar facility, the one that's connected to the Blue Lake plant, is now up and running, and that will provide about 10% of our energy there. And the council is planning on 10 community solar gardens for 2016. So we're trying to do our bit to lower greenhouse
thank
gases.
You. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you for the update.
I got warned.
You got more?
I got warned.
Oh, okay. You got warned. Well, I mean, that's exactly what we like to hear, you know, what's going on with our partners around town. So. Julie, what's happening up north?
I didn't make it this morning because I was up in northwest Minnesota yesterday afternoon for a meeting, but Anna is going to be presenting at our Red River Basin Conference in Grand Forks in January on climate change, so that'll be interesting, along with panel from North Dakota and Manitoba. So, and then Commissioner Stein will be presenting on water quality issues in Minnesota. Again, he's become kind of a regular, popular, much requested speaker. So, and
watch out.
No, he has. I'm not kidding. He has. But other than that, I wish I could have made it this morning, but I was too far north. So, if they ever move the meetings north, I'll. Yeah. Attend.
Besides, you read the agenda and said 9 tonight, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'd go after the meeting today. And
all right, Eric.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Anything?
Well, just real quick, the first presentation this morning, I actually talked to Weston about a telephone call that I received a couple days ago from an undergrad student at the University of Minnesota. He's working with some MBA students at the Carlson School, the McKnight Foundation, and the Itasca Project to work with water sector folks and find out, get feedback on creating kind of a water cluster to develop in Minnesota. And I just thought it was very interesting that, you know, our water report, the, you know, economic profile.
Things are kind of aligning a little.
Yeah, and it's exciting to see some spin-off projects being picked up on work that was started here. So.
Yeah, that's good. We sometimes forget about it, to see the alignment and how it actually does come together every once in a while. You know, usually it's kind of like this, but this one kind of came together. My colleague to my right.
Yes. Two things. I'm wearing a gonorrhea tie in honor of the fact that I got gonorrhea.
I wouldn't recognize.
In honor of the fact that this is World Antibiotic Awareness Week, and the governor has declared this week as the Get Smart, Know When Antibiotics Work Week. And so actually, as we're speaking now, there's a Twitter conference going on about antibiotics. It's a huge issue that's, I think, is one of the emerging public health issues in the state, and something that many of us at this table have some responsibility for. So we're planning for an antibiotic resistance summit in January of this year, so be ready for that. The other is yesterday we hosted and planned a health impact assessment coalition conference. Had over 150 people from Minnesota and other states around here looking at health impact assessments. It's a bigger conference than the national conference. Had really some really good information. We are leaders in this state for the, well, I mean, there are other states that have done more than us, but we really, I think, are doing health impact assessments in a much broader way, looking at not only environmental siting kinds of issues, but also policy issues in a whole variety of areas. So that's really kind of fun.
And for those of you that don't know, Commissioner Ellinger is now the president of their national organization, so his time is going to be shared with the national organization plus the department. So congratulations on that.
Condolences.
High honor and condolences also, yes. Absolutely. And I also was thinking of you this morning when, you know, your issue has always been health and all policies, and you could surely see that alignment today as we talked about climate change and why do we do anything. We do it to have better quality of life for people, don't we? And obviously, health and all policies is absolutely key and critical. So you're on the front line with that. We'll duck by you, Kate.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chair, so stepping back from this morning a little bit, the citizen members continue to try to align our contributions and focus on EQB in increasingly productive ways. So we are really excited about having, you know, as we are like genuinely sort of nerdily excited about the management analysis and development recommendations. So I think that will help us think about, not just think about, but be more and more focused on how we add value and raise the impact and profile of the EQB. So we all had lunch together. You know, we meet in the cafeteria and talk about how we contribute. And so I'm just genuinely excited to be working with the group of citizen members and then the board more broadly. And this morning, I think it's the event this morning, I think, shows in the best way of the convening power of the Environmental Quality Board. I was saying to Will, I don't think there is another group in the state of Minnesota that has that kind of potential for convening in terms of bringing together the different state agency perspectives, the lieutenant governor, and then the people in that room, I think, wouldn't have come if it wasn't who convening it, the group convening it would have been different. So I think that's really important to recognize. And I will be going to Paris. I'm part of the University of Minnesota delegation, and you know, I have the EQB hat as well, so I will be happy to report back. We are planning an initial very quick after COP21 event on December 16th. It'll be hosted at the Institute on the Environment with Climate Generation and some of the other educational partners going. So just throwing it out there, look for more information. And I think I hope that EQB will continue to think about how to use our informing each other capabilities, our cross agency capabilities, but also the convening aspect of what we do and the potential we have to do that. And I think today was a really great example.
And your comments were, I'm always expecting folks who give a historical perspective to be, you know, with gray hair, but you came in with this wonderful historical perspective on meetings over the past.
I wasn't at the 1992 Earth Summit, you know, I was still in elementary school.
Yeah.
But
you were listening.
I did get to go to COP 15 and COP 16, so yeah. I have seen some of this develop, yeah.
My only relation with cops is the other side of it. So, so is there a word nerdily?
I like that one.
Okay,
that word,
you said yeah. Nerdily. There is.
You're first.
Yeah. I think so.
If not,
nerdily.
If not, it is now.
It is now. That's right.
Brian? 5 minutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you pointed out, I did read the agenda carefully, and it did say PM, so I wasn't at the meeting this morning either. But you did ask for random thoughts.
I did, yes.
So here goes. I'll give you some random thoughts. And you did also ask for some historical input. So to combine both historical input and some random thoughts together, first of all, from an agency perspective, Bowser has three water planning groups, the Metro, North, and South. And we are focusing more on asking questions about what individual water plans have to do with climate change, how they're preparing for climate change, and getting that thought put into people's minds. But I think one would not be honest if they didn't say to themselves, climate change is not universally accepted. Now, the question is, how do we get to a few people with a few people read a county water plan? Very few, really. Probably watershed districts as well. Julie, you know how many people read your watershed district plan, right? It's not a lot.
No.
So the challenge is to get to more people. How do you get to more people? How do you get out to the citizens and actually convince them of something? Well, here's where I'll try to offer some historical perspective. We are in the midst right now of one of Minnesota's greatest traditions, deer hunting season. Deer hunting season started a week or so ago, and it will end this Sunday. Now, I've been a hunter for a long time, and so we hunt in northern Minnesota. And in northern Minnesota, as many of you know, there are a lot more swamps than there is high ground. It's wet up there. And one of the things I've always told my sons is, here's how hunting goes in Minnesota. The first weekend, the swamps are never iced over. You're going to be sloshing. We're probably going to be sitting and staying out of the swamps. The second weekend, there's a pretty good chance they're going to be froze over, at least for foot traffic, where we can drive deer out of them. The third weekend, they're going to be froze over. That's just the way it is. Well, it's not that way this year. As Commissioner Stein pointed out, October was the warmest month ever. Well, I can tell you it's been pretty warm November as well for someone who's been sitting out in the woods for a bit here. And given the fact that we just got 2 inches of rain over the last couple of days, I can pretty much assure you that regardless of what the weather holds in the next few days, those swamps are not going to be froze over. So it impacts our hunting camp. But Commissioner Lambert probably has a better idea how many deer hunting licenses are sold in the state of Minnesota. 500,000 people can be touched by this event now. Not a few people reading a county water plan. There's an ability to say to 500,000 people in the state of Minnesota right now, did you notice something's changing? So that was my random thought in order to tie together a little bit of historical perspective with the ability to reach a greater number of people than would ordinarily read a newspaper, read a water plan, read a report. This is real stuff. It's really affecting people. So now here again, we've pondered this question around this board table before. How do you reach all those people? And I'm simply pointing out here, this is an opportunity. My sons are literally asking me, what was it like 30 years ago? And I say, well, it's not even 30 years ago. It's less than that. But I gave them this progression. They're feet on the ground that understand that and go, what is changing? Well, we can use that opportunity to reach a lot of people. So that's my random thought.
I like random thoughts. We'll forever call this little session random thoughts. All right. Thank you, John.
I can't move that. It's cool. I think you can hear me. Mr. Chair, I have to apologize. I want to talk again about this morning, what happened this morning. And I certainly want to congratulate and thank EQB staff for what they did in bringing that together. It was outstanding, and I hope that can be done when everybody gets back from Paris. I think that's very important. I was at a table of probably 9 people, and I was the only one not going to Paris. Of course, quite envious, but also excited, too, about the people that are going over there. And there were 2 young people at the table, one a St. John's student, and the other young woman is a student at the School of Environmental Studies, which is actually a high school in the South Metro. They were planning on going, and their trip was canceled because of the events in Paris. But somehow they arranged it. A couple of parents stepped forward, and they are going independently to Paris. And I found that very admirable. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to scare them away from this event. Another thing that happened at the table is I was able to kind of push our publication here. People really weren't aware of it. And I thought in terms of thinking about the issues in Paris, that this would be important. It isn't necessarily the Bible on climate change, but it really identifies the issues that probably are going to be talked about there. And people were very interested in picking that up. And I know there was a single page or two that probably was even more useful than this. And I wanted to thank Kate for what she said and the commissioners, Commissioner Stein and Rothman, for what you said. I found your statements very moving. And especially the challenge to us as the EQB, as people come back from Paris, that come and talk to us. We need to hear that. So thank you.
Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few few top-of-mind things going on. I was out at the workshop this morning, so I can't talk about that. But related to EQB work, I'll talk a little bit about environmental review, a little bit about silica sand, and then close on health and all policies thing. So we are in the midst of a couple of big environmental review processes, obviously. One of them is PolyMet, and we're at the point until December 8th. We're
that?
Actually...
Poly what?
PolyMet, yeah. I find when I'm typing, I keep typing PolyMent. There's an N because M-E-N-T is more common. Well, but in any event, we are accepting public comments on the adequacy of the final EIS, which we put out a couple weeks ago. And I think that comment period is open until December 8th. And as per the environmental review statutes, which we are the keepers of, that review looks at 3 narrow parameters. Is the does the EIS address all of the issues identified in scoping? Does the EIS adequately consider the public comments that were received in the public comment period? And third, did we follow the laws and the rules when we developed the EIS? So we're accepting comments now. We're looking forward to getting those comments and proceeding with the EIS. Secondarily, we just closed the public comment period on the Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Project up in Fargo-Moorhead. And we're going to be in the process of analyzing those comments and then putting forward a final EIS sometime in 16. And that's related to, as everybody knows, a large flood control project. Julie knows this better than anybody up in the Red River Valley area. And I had a public meeting up there about 2 weeks ago now, was it, Julie?
Yep.
And had a couple hundred people in attendance, I guess it was. And Got a lot of public comments. It's still the kind of comments, I hate it, I love it. It's not the kind of comments we really are looking for, but that's the nature of the beast. So that we're in the middle of that one, and I'm pleased to announce that we denied a request for an environmental assessment worksheet on muskie stocking on Pelican Lake in Otter Tail County. The Lake Association had asked that we do an environmental assessment worksheet on a muskie stocking effort that we were going to do, which we have done every year for 27 years, and we denied that. There were concerns that muskies would be taking young children and threatening swimmers. So we denied that EAW, and subsequently that was upheld by a judge as well. On the other side of the coin, we recently were given authority to require a permit for establishing a silica sand mine within a mile of a trout stream. It was given to us, in 12 or 13, I think, Will. And the first case we had was one which is called Erickson Mine, and we had all, if this group heard of Erickson Mine, they had acquired an existing sand and gravel operation. We're proposing to use it for silica sand for frac sand industry. We advised them they needed a permit from the state. They contested that. We lost in the Court of Appeals. We took it to the Supreme Court, and we lost to the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals essentially said they can continue to take sand and gravel from that operation in the volume that they have been permitted in the past. The use of it doesn't make any difference. The permit that was standing for sand and gravel was legitimate. So that's the only project we've had to date that came to us for a permit, and so right now we have no pending permits for the trout stream setback. And the last thing I want to mention is we were pleased to announce on Friday that we will have a little bit of green in Black Friday. We have announced that we'll have free park Friday on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And when I did a little press run that, I referenced Commissioner Ehlinger and said, Commissioner says health and all policies, and that health doesn't come from a doctor in a bottle. It comes from getting out and doing healthy things. And so we're going to promote that. And I've gotten just phenomenal public reaction to that. So all state parks will be open for free on Friday after Thanksgiving. I'm told that the average American consumes 4,500 calories on Thanksgiving. I'm advised that you burn off about 300 calories an hour for walking. Do the math. Start at midnight. You're done at 3. Go home and have a beer. So.
You do run the largest health facility in the state.
There we go.
Yeah.
In the state parks.
That's right. Well, thank you. That's probably the nicest thing you've done for us.
I just don't point out for you all the nice things I do for you. Think of those muskies.
Really? Do they? Do they, like, take children?
Not in the human record. Not on the human record, I would
Well, on that one, I want to thank Tom personally, because we have gone to Fair Hills Resort with our kids almost annually, and
they still have the same number of kids today as they did when you started?
They're alive. Okay. They're alive. But the rumors are that these muskie are 6 feet long or 5 feet long, and they hang out underneath the docks, and they'll gobble up every other small fish around, including the walleye. So yeah. That's very important.
That's decision. The rumor.
So yeah. Thank you, personally.
Okay, I think. All right. I'll ask Will to give a report, and then we'll move straight into the Minnesota Water Industry Economic Profile. Will?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple brief updates. We initiated a good cause exempt rulemaking this week to move forward the changes that were required in the 2015 special session law related to expanded trails. And so the judge will take a look at the rule that we move forward. The comment period is brief. It'll close here next Wednesday, and then depending on when we hear back on that, we'll probably have a rule before the board to approve and adopt in December. In terms of scheduling, please be on the lookout, and we'll talk a little bit more about this when Kristen does her presentation on the planning assessment. We're looking at trying to do a half-day work planning retreat with the board as early as January, so we're working with your scheduling assistants to try and find some time to set aside, hopefully as early as January. If we can't do January, we'll look a little bit later in the year, but we're looking to move forward on that as well. And then our Our December meeting will focus on pipeline issues. We intend to bring forward the report, a final version for approval, and discuss some environmental review requirements related to the projects that are underway. So that's all.
All right, good. Weston, we blew you off the last time, and so we humbly apologize for that. We're anxious to hear from you, and so again, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Weston Merrick, Department of Economic, or Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Well, that's the first thing I need to tell you guys. Since the completion of this report, I've actually moved on to MMB, and I'm just doing a
little
bit.
Sorry to hear that.
Yes, doing return on investment analyses for corrections and human services programs. Commissioner Stephen Clark asked me to come in and pinch hit a little bit for this. So very excited to share this report with you. As we know, this is part of the broader water quality and quantity report. It's also a standalone document that DEED is using to look at the water technology sector. Figure out the opportunities there, and also what the size, shape, and composition of the industry is like. I will point out that the full report is at min.gov/deed/water. There is a lot here, and I'm going to just share a very narrow slice of it here today. It also is in the water policy report, the wonderful document that Eric Dahl and Nan Henderson spearheaded. We're in the back of the report. And it's a great short look at it if you're not interested in the full report. What we found in doing this is that the water industry is growing quickly, creating high-paying jobs, and bringing in revenue from exports for the state of Minnesota. This is happening under macroeconomic conditions where water-related products are in increasing demand due to water stress conditions. We're all very familiar with these water stress conditions. California comes first to mind. A lot of the water stress conditions throughout the world and in right here in Minnesota, particularly in southern Minnesota. The industry in Minnesota is growing thanks to some tremendous assets that the state has. Innovative companies, complementary industries, ag and food manufacturing come first to mind, those industries that need a lot of clean and available water. Talented workforce and supporting institutions, UMN, the state of Minnesota, a lot of the institutions that are helping to promote this industry and to promote clean and available water. And progressive policies, and I think two of them that come to mind that this board will be very familiar with that we'll look at a little bit, the LCCMR and the Legacy Amendment are helping to support the industry. This suggests an emerging cluster, and I know Director Soifert, you don't like the word cluster, but I will say it's a term of art in economics. And what a cluster is a critical mass of firms in a geographic area that we tend to see when a cluster forms increase productivity, increase innovation in the form of patenting and exports, and really increased employment and prosperity for the state. And so that's what we want to see here. We believe in this report that we found that this is an emerging cluster. We want to get to a full cluster status. So what is the water industry? I think that'd be the first question I would have. We define the water industry as products and services that improve the use, quality, and flow of water. We can see four segments up here, and I'm going to point to the report a lot, but I'll point first here that we go into a lot of depth into each of these areas in the report, but for the purposes of this presentation, I'm just going to roll it all together into the water industry. But we have four industries, treatment products and services. We see things like filtration and purification, disinfection. Companies like Dow and GE in Minnesota are very, very large in this space. Infrastructure projects, these are pumps and pipes, sewers and agriculture water management. Companies like a company, one of those, the biggest companies in the world, is right here in St. Paul, it's Pentair. Efficiency products and services, meters, controls, low flow fixtures, Ecolab is large in this space. And the last one is we group together our public water utilities, and including the Met Council in that place, as well as some of the localities and local governments and units of government that are important here. Now, I will say that companies certainly do traverse multiple of these categories. And in some places, we could argue that these categories duplicate each other. And we're okay with that argument. We just wanted to provide some clarity and allow a little bit more of a granular sense of what's going on in the industry. So that's what's in. We call that the core water industry. That's what this report is going to take a look at in the employment space and the export space. We also have the water-enabled industries. These are industries that are tied acutely to having clean and available water. Things like agriculture, fishing, shipping, recreation. These are dependent on products and services that come from that core water industry. And what we see is changes in this core water industry and the ability to create lots of clean and available water are going to have wide ripple effects, pun intended, on the water-enabled industry. But for the purposes of this report, we're talking just about the core water industry. Very quickly on method, because I know that this isn't the most interesting part for most people. But to look at the employment piece, we did two things. First, we worked with a consultant, Collaborative Economics. Collaborative Economics also helped us with the Clean Energy Report that we did about a year and a half ago at Deed and presented here at EQB with Commerce and a lot of other ag and a lot of other agencies. So we used a similar methodology as that. We looked at administrative data sets, a data set called the National Establishment Time Series data set, NETS. Essentially what this is a census of every single business in the state of Minnesota and their employment over the last 20 years. So we went through that data set to figure out which of the companies fell in the water industry and which fell out. And we also supplemented that with some survey work, particularly of the large companies. We wanted to be able to grab the employment in companies that water products might not be their primary product. Someone like a Dow, they're primarily working in other chemical spaces, not in water disinfectants and other water products. But we wanted to make sure we were able to grab specifically what their water employment is. So we surveyed those companies. Wages, we went to Deeds Unemployment Insurance Records. This is a database of all payroll paid to employees in the state over the last 30 or 40 years. Queried that for the relevant data and the relevant companies. And then more on the qualitative side, the trade talent innovation, we worked with some proprietary databases and experts and, of course, looked at previous research. So what did we actually find? Here are our employment findings, and I'd say the headlines from this report. It's really the first time we were able to quantify the employment, payroll, and average wages in the state, which is pretty powerful. We found that there were 13,500 employees in the first quarter of 2014 in 1,200 establishments. Establishments are just single business locations. Over the last 10 years, we've added in the state about 1,500 workers and have grown at a rate of 13% during the time period. Now, if we compare that to the state overall, and that's what this graph does here, the state overall employment grew 4% during the period. So we've seen an industry that's grown three times more rapidly than state employment. Total payroll was $885 million in 2014. That's up 15% from $760 million in 2004, adjusted for inflation. And wages were at $65,500 a year. That is 27% higher than the state wage of $51,600 in 2014. So these are very good jobs as well. So we got, going back to those main points, we got a fast-growing industry that's producing a lot of wages and impacting the state economy in that way, and they're also creating good jobs. Another way that they're helping the state economy is in exports. Minnesota ranked 8th overall in water technology exports at $870 million. That is more than doubled in the last 10 years. That is remarkable, the growth that we've seen in this industry. We've added over $400 million in exports. And let me just add, these are only international exports. We're unable to track intrastate or state-to-state exports. Obviously, there's no border guard checking to see what's in a truck in North Dakota. So this figure right here is just what we're sending abroad. Tremendous amount of money. And what I thought was one of the big headlines of this that we had never realized before is that Minnesota is third nationally in per capita exports of water technology. behind only Delaware and Texas. It's about $160 per every man, woman, and child in the state. So a tremendous amount of activity and very, very high levels relative to other states. Very much important. We're ahead of Wisconsin in all those categories. Just thought I'd point that out.
Say that again.
We're ahead of Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, that's what I thought.
In all of the categories. Wisconsin gets a lot of attention for their water tech, and rightfully so in some places, but we're beating them here, so that's good. Exports are one sign of innovation, right? You export a product, somebody demands a product because it's really good, the product that they're importing, or it's cheaper. And so those are signs of innovation. Another sign of innovation, of course, is patenting activity. Again, Minnesota's ahead of Wisconsin. Just want to point that out. And Minnesota overall is the ninth overall patenter. We have the ninth most patents from 2010 to 2014 in the United States. Again, we are third per capita in the U.S. in patenting activity. So a lot of activities going on here. The right side, you can see some of our top patenters. Most of those names you'll recognize. The one that sticks out is Imbro. It's an environmental research and testing laboratory. I don't know a lot about them. From what I've looked at, it looks like they create a lot of patents, and then they sell those patents to other individuals to develop and sell the technologies. Perhaps some of you know more about Imbro than me and be happy to learn. So what is driving this growth? This report has found that Minnesota has a rare collection of assets that are helping to promote the broader water technology cluster. Again, an industry cluster is a geographic concentration of interconnected businesses, suppliers, and institutions in a particular industry. When we see clusters, they tend to be signs of increasing productivity, increasing innovation in the form of patenting and exports, and also increasing employment and wages and therefore prosperity in an area. Some prominent examples of clusters that you all recognize are Hollywood for film and Detroit for automobiles. One of the more recent clusters that's very hot right now is Houston for pumping things out of the ground. But all of those clusters and all the clusters that have been identified tend to have some common characteristics. We see complementary industries. One of the famous examples of these is Silicon Valley, obviously famous for processors. But prior to processors, what was happening in Silicon Valley, it was actually a cluster for radios. Radios use very similar technology as processors for computers, very similar skill set as far as individuals. And so those complementary industries help shape new industries, and we can see that in Minnesota in the form of complementary industries like food manufacturing and agriculture. They have a lot of demand for water products, and they pull those products forward in an area. Policies and laws, natural resources, supporting institutions and industries, business assistance and financing, academic industries, and supply chain. We go into very deep detail in the report in all these areas. Again, men.gov/deed/water. And I recommend you guys take a look at that if you're interested. In particular, we look a lot at academic industries, particularly UMN and the wonderful things that are going on there. They're very important to clusters, and so that is some great detail there. But for the sake of time, I'm just going to focus on two or three of these. And really, I'm going to do that because we are part of this broader water quality and quantity study. And there was a lot of discussion early in this process in June and in May about the fit of this economic piece, this water tech piece, with the broader water quality and quantity piece. Is this water technology helping water quality and quantity? Is it neutral? Or is it actually perhaps hurting the quality and quantity of our water? And so we looked a little bit at history with clusters. And one of the things that you find very clearly in the academic research of clusters is that clusters become because of weird quirks, some strange oddity, often in natural resources or policies and laws or business assistance and financing, exists in an area that gives firms in that area a competitive advantage. They then use that competitive edge to ship out to other areas and to grow. So one of my favorite examples is Hollywood. Why did Hollywood become the cluster, the multi-billion, hundreds of billion dollar mecca for movies that it is? Well, if you look back at the history, in the early 1900s, all filmmaking happened in New Jersey. Thomas Edison's company owned the patent for filmmaking. Well, some entrepreneurial filmmakers didn't want to pay the royalties to the Edison Corporation, and so they just moved out to California, where the patents were not being enforced. It was a big country then. They couldn't enforce the patent. Nice weather helped, I think, and that's a natural resource that we can talk about for Hollywood. But those quirks are really important to why clusters form. In Minnesota, we see a lot of natural resources. Obviously, we're very proud of our 15,000 lakes and being the headwaters of the Mississippi, and have done a lot in the form of policies and laws and financing to promote clean water in the state. We provided a lot of financing to meet those goals. And when things like that happen, you start to see industry pop up because there's demand. We can think of a basic example in Minnesota. Let's say we, through the LCCMR, or more likely the Clean Water Fund, we fund a project that helps reduce phosphorus in a lake. So a municipality is going to contract out to a company. Maybe this company has a new technology that's really good at reducing phosphorus in a lake, or a new piece of technology that prevents phosphorus from getting into the water. That company can use that new technology. They gain some expertise with that new technology. They learn what works, what doesn't work. They are able to then maybe roll it out broader to other communities interested in lowering their phosphorus in the area through the Clean Water Fund. They get more expertise, they become more competitive, and they're able to ship it out to other states, that technology, or ship it out internationally. Through that way, by improving quality and quantity of water, we've also improved the water technology cluster. So there is a very strong connection. Now, I don't want to overplay that connection. It's possible that that firm could arise here or elsewhere, and it's possible that they won't gain that competitive advantage. But historically, this is what we tend to see, that policies and laws play a very important role in the formation of clusters. So I'll end quickly on why this is important, that we grow the water cluster. We certainly see, and this report shows, that there's an opportunity to increase employment. There's an opportunity to create a more prosperous state because of these rare assets that Minnesota has. Innovative firms, 3M, Pentair, Ecolab. Sporting institutions are our wonderful nonprofits that are here that are interested in the space. The UMN, the government that has done so much work in this area, Met Council and other entities like that. Progressive laws and policies that exist in the state, as well as the abundant resources of having all these lakes and all the water here in Minnesota, and the fact that spurs food manufacturing and agriculture, which drives demand. Now, I call those rare assets. They're certainly rare, but they're not unique. There are a lot of other states that have many of these assets and are in many places further along than us in these assets. We can only look just across the border and see Wisconsin has many of these assets, and they are investing heavily in these assets. They have a water technology cluster organization. Eric mentioned Minnesota's nascent effort to do that. They've had this industry group for years. The industry group has actually found funding to start an incubator in the state that fosters new technologies. And that story in Wisconsin is happening in a lot of other places. So there is an imperative here that if Minnesota wants to be the water technology cluster, that the state make that entities in the state of Minnesota, public and private, make additional investments in the water technology space. The report talks about that effort, what the state could do. We surveyed a wide swath of business leaders to get their sense of what we could do. And the report also looks at best practices in other states. So I recommend going out and seeing what we could do in those places. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thanks, Justin. A nice overview of the water technology report and the questions. Mr.
Sure. Merrick, you presented a slide that showed Texas as being a clear leader in exports.
Yeah.
Can you give us an idea of what it is there? What are the products? Is it is it pipe and pumps from the oil pipe industry?
You're exactly right. That is the product. It is. They have used their competencies in pumps and pipes in oil to turn that over into water. And that's one of those complementary industry things that I was talking about. And they are head and shoulders above everybody else. I think they might be larger than the next seven combined.
And then, okay, what I'm trying to get at is you look at the water technology exports ahead of us.
Yes.
Which ones are surprising that we're not doing or surprising that they are doing? Put it either way. You get the idea, pipes and pumps for Texas, okay, but you've got Michigan in there, you know, similar geography. You've got states that are much more similar to us. What
yeah. I think you see a lot of common characteristics between all the states ahead of us. They have their large proximity to water, a lot of great lake states in here, and they have a lot of competencies in developing those water technologies. Now, I haven't I looked in deeply into Texas, why those export numbers are so big, and that's pipes and pumps. California, again, pipes and pumps, but also some of the technology pieces associated with water. I haven't done so much research in the other areas. My guess is that, a couple things. These are huge economies as well, so we can't discount that. These are economies that are bigger. Every single one of those economies is larger than Minnesota. And so that could play part of the role. And I think as well, they just have those expertise in those areas. And you could think about some of the big water companies that are in each one of these states, headquartered in these states. One of them, the one to look at is Illinois. That's where Pentair acquired Nalco. Nalco is the water tech arm of Pentair. It actually made them, that acquisition a couple years ago, made them the largest company in water tech. They still have all of their facilities in Illinois. They may be headquartered here now because of Pentair, but all their facilities are still in Illinois. So they're manufacturing there. And I think that's one lesson this report points out is that as well as we're doing, we're still not doing a lot of the manufacturing.
John?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make the observation which you made, Weston, which is the Great Lakes states. And the number of states in the Great Lakes region have reported on their water economies.
Absolutely.
And I think so there's really good data about those states, which also helps. But I just would point out that as part of the Great Lakes Commission, which I'm a part, they're undertaking what they call blue water accounting, which is an effort to try to put some clarity around the investments and the opportunities on the water technology and infrastructure of the Great Lakes region, because so much water is there, so much fresh water. It's the largest freshwater reserve on the face of the planet. There's a lot going into protecting those resources, managing those resources, and then remediating resources. So there's a huge investment going on simply because we're on the Great Lakes, I would say. That's one observation that rings true. But I thought it would be interesting to, and you started to do it, is there a comparison on the value of the economic activity compared to the percentage of the state's overall economy? Did the report look at that?
Yeah, so we look in per capita terms, which would be close. It wouldn't be exactly the same, but they are highly correlated. And the report does have a list of the per capita ratios. It wouldn't be a tremendous amount of effort, though, for the report lays out the exports that are related to it and the patenting. You could look at that very easily, just divided by GDP, and that would be possible. Okay. I would like to point out, though, Great Lakes Commission is an excellent resource, and I believe the Lieutenant Governor even took some of this data and presented it at the Great Lakes Commission a couple of months back. One of the things they have reports as well about the size of the water industry. Now, they view it as the water-enabled industry, so if you go out to their reports, you can actually see how every state compares in water-enabled industries. We chose to get a little more focused so that we could actually make some actionable recommendations, but they have a wonderful report about water-enabled industries.
Yeah, and Weston, thank you for this update on this and this report. And thank you also for the cautionary tale that you told, that you raised in that, in terms of, is this good, bad, or indifferent? Is there some ups and downs? Because there's always, and I was looking, not just thinking not necessarily about clusters, but I was thinking about industries, and particularly two industries came to mind. One is the healthcare industry, where we get really enamored with all the technology and all the inventions, and so we invest all of our resources in the treatment pieces and forget about the really low-cost, non-sexy prevention kinds of things. Similarly, in the fire industry, where we spend all, so much on suppression and very little on prevention compared to some other places. So even though, you know, when we always focus on the economic things, the proprietary things, the entrepreneurial kinds of things, I think part of the, what this board has to always do is keep track of really the public good, the upstream prevention, the low-cost things that maybe aren't sexy but are really essential if any of these other things are going to continue.
Excellent point. Completely agree.
Other questions or comments for Weston? I was interested in California in terms of the amount of patents that have come out of it. Is it the whole issue of a crisis is a horrible thing to waste, and consequently you ramp up the discovery process? Or
yeah, I think California, if you look at any patenting index, is probably at the top of almost every industry, just because of the technology companies that are out there, and that tends to be the type of thing that we see getting patented. But I also think it's a little interesting if you look on per capita terms. They're not nearly as high. They're behind us. But one would hope that they would be investing in technologies like this.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So then to our next item of business on the agenda, and that is the management analysis and development recommendations. I would invite Kristen Batson, Director of Management Analysis and Development, to come on up. Thank you for being here, Kristen.
Thank you, Chair Fredrickson. Great to be here. Just give me a minute, please, to switch
slideshows.
That could get very interesting. I do. Yeah, I'm not familiar with this keyboard. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Good tech assistance is hard to find. Glad it came with the room.
Unlike Stein of Mantrolls.
Thank you, Commissioner Stein.
You're welcome.
My name is Kristen Batson. I'm the Director of Management Analysis and Development. We are a fee-for-service management consulting division that is part of Minnesota Management and Budget. We are celebrating our 30th anniversary this year of being in state government. We also work for, thank you, we also work for any public entity in Minnesota, but the bulk of our work is in state government. I am really happy to be here to review this project with you. It was a very enjoyable project, and I appreciate the participation, the widespread participation and engagement that I received in conducting the interviews for this project. I conducted 34 interviews overall with board members, EQB staff members, technical representatives, and then your interagency partners at member agencies. Oops. There we go. The background for this project is kind of a perfect storm, really. Wilk contacted me last spring and came to me with this problem of, we have so much work to do, and it requires so much interagency coordination to do all this good work, that we find ourselves spending most of our time organizing resources to get the work done, and that leaves us very little time to do this really important work. And so the background for that, I think, is Executive Order 1132, which really carved out a vision and an agenda for the EQB that is very compelling and very exciting. You have a relatively new board that is committed and engaged, and you can see the interaction and the cooperation all throughout this meeting. So there is that in the background, that you had a lot of interest in really driving a powerful agenda here. EQB has a talented and effective staff, really bright and committed, but very small, and that's a theme that will last throughout this report. Very knowledgeable partners. EQB has a long, positive history in state government, and a lot of your interagency partners and your technical representatives have been involved in the EQB's work for a long time and are deeply knowledgeable and committed and have a lot of historical knowledge about the issues that the EQB is working on. So, again, a huge asset for you. However, there have been significant changes in the scope of the EQB, in the function of the EQB. This organization has been through a lot of changes in the past decade, and so you are all still sort of grappling with those changes and forming this new organization that is emerging from the changes of the past decade. And resources are stretched. There is way more good work to be done than there are resources to do it. And so a big part of this project was trying to figure out how we can best deploy resources to get as much of that good work done as possible. So when Will and I sat down to really scope out and plan this project, there were lots of questions on his mind, and all of them really were about this theme of how do we prioritize, how do we operationalize? And so the questions that Will charged me with looking at were, what's the best way for the EQB to identify and secure the interagency staff resources necessary to carry out the board's priorities? How can we do that most efficiently? How can the EQB better operationalize those priorities? To what extent is the current system of the member agency technical representatives meeting the EQB's needs concerning interagency work? What barriers, other than financial, prevent the EQB from supporting more robust interagency initiatives? Given the limited staff resources, how can we move forward on issues of emerging concern? What's the most efficient way to do that? And then how can we measure and improve interagency environmental outcomes? And what's the board's role in this? So a lot of compelling questions, all really circling around how do we operationalize, how do we plan, how do we prioritize? So again, I talked with four different groups of stakeholders, board, EQB staff, technical representatives, and then staff from member agencies who've been involved in these interagency projects. There were several findings from these interviews that were from all of these groups equally and were very strong findings, so I'll lead with those. First of all, the role and the work of the EQB is valued. To a person, people were able to articulate, this is why the EQB needs to exist. We need an entity that can help us lead and coordinate on these cross-cutting issues, and that's really what we're looking to the EQB for. Very strong finding there. EQB staff are appreciated. There was a lot of appreciation and admiration for new staff at the EQB, their energy, their commitment, their smarts. There was a strong desire across all groups for more frequent planning. And I'll get to more of that later. There is a generally high opinion of the recent interagency projects from the past 4 years or so. A lot of positive feelings about the work that has been done over that period of time. A couple notable exceptions to that, but overall strong. There was a desire for more public engagement on the part of the EQB, and that desire showed up differently. Not everyone had the same idea about how the EQB should engage the public, but a pretty strong, consistent desire to talk about that some more and discuss that. What is our role vis-a-vis public engagement, and what is the best way for us to go about that? Also, no surprise, widely acknowledged need for more resources. a very, very common theme of this project was, how do we identify and deploy resources? And there isn't, you know, a person involved in any of this who is sitting around waiting for work to do. So there's a lot of busy people, and the need for more resources was a very common theme. So I broke the board interview findings into the findings that come from board members who are state government workers and then board members who are from the public, different perspectives. Findings from the state government board members included a desire for more public engagement. Again, that did not show up as exactly the same idea, but just a common wondering about what should we be doing vis-a-vis public engagement and how should that look at the EQB. There was a strong willingness and support to provide resources for interagency projects. It was clear that you all saw a high return on investment for that. You saw the need. You were bought into to doing that work together. And then I think coupled with that, perhaps a desire for more planning discussions to better plan together and discuss together, given limited resources, what should the priorities for this interagency work be? What is the highest use of these resources? And we'll talk more about planning later. From the public board members, a strong appreciation across the board for the renewed vitality of the EQB, and coming from folks who it was obvious cared deeply and had been watching the EQB for a long time, and really just appreciated the renewed focus and energy and all of the good assets that are in place right now to do the EQB's work. Also, I did not want this to get lost, appreciation for the renewed and enhanced efforts to engage public board members. And I think Kate Knuth spoke to that earlier, and very, very happy to have that conversation on the table and to be participating in that. And again, I'm starting to sound like a broken record, a desire for more planning. When I spoke with EQB staff, again, and everyone is approaching this from a different perspective, staff were focused on a clear acknowledgement that to do their work effectively, they need productive relationships. They're constantly working across borders to get this work done. So they very clearly understood they need to have productive relationships, and to that end, there has to be good communication to do this work efficiently and effectively. Deep appreciation for the contributions of interagency partners. When they ask for someone to devote a few months of time to work on a report, there was an acknowledgement of what that ask entails and the appreciation for the partnership and the work that they're getting in return. At this point in time, and this was early summer or midsummer, there were concerns about staffing levels, EQB staffing levels for environmental review. I think those concerns have been addressed. But this was coming on the tails of some legislation that came out of last session that asked you to focus on environmental review. And so there were just some concerns about, do we have the adequate staff to do that? There was also a desire for clarity on the role of technical representatives. Everyone acknowledged that this role has changed, and that there needs to be some more clarity for everyone concerned. There was frustration among this group at time spent negotiating for and identifying interagency resources. It's the pre-work that keeps us from getting to the work we all really want to be doing. And so how can we do that more efficiently? And there was also some frustration at a perceived lack of accountability for EQB project participation, understanding that everyone that is partnering with them has full plates, has other supervisors, has other accountabilities, and so there was a worry that sometimes the interagency work takes a backseat to that. When I spoke with the technical representatives, their focus was primarily about their role. Across the board acknowledgement that the role has changed, and a lot of questions about what the new role should be and wanting some clarity on that. There was also concern about EQB environmental review staffing levels. The technical representatives have a lot of history and expertise in environmental review. They care deeply about it, and so this was an area of concern for them. They felt like there is an agenda there and wanted to make sure that there were adequate staff resources for that. They felt conflicted in that they felt called upon to help identify staff resources at their agencies for interagency projects. And depending on the agency, the size and the focus and the mission of the agency, they didn't always feel able to do that. So that created some awkwardness for some of them. There was also some frustration with the monthly, I believe, technical representative meetings, again, tied to the clarity of their role. If the role's clear, then the meeting agendas will clear up. And so those two were sort of partner findings. They also felt like they could be better ambassadors at their agencies for the EQB and for EQB projects if they were given more information about the work. And really almost a suggestion that, you know, use us and you can use us more in that role, but we need certain information about the projects to help fulfill that ambassador role. They're also requested more lead time and project specifics to identify staff resources and to help negotiate and navigate within their agencies. And again, to fulfill that ambassador role. And then practices differ among agencies, but the technical representatives that are in the practice of meeting with their commissioner before EQB board meetings felt like that was valuable and good to carve out some time to talk about the upcoming agenda or the upcoming issues as it impacted or affected their own agency, and to have that conversation with their commissioner. The last group of folks that I spoke with were folks who were interagency partners and had worked on interagency projects over the past probably 3-4 years. A lot of these folks said that they feel pressured to say yes when asked if they can work on an interagency project. Just said, you know, I said yes, I didn't have the time, but I didn't really feel like I could say no. And I feel like it's important to get that in here. There was a desire for more efficiency on interagency projects and more standard practices and procedures, perhaps more phone meetings or webinar meetings when possible, uses of things like SharePoint just to create some efficiencies in how projects are conducted and managed. There was a desire among this group for more upper-level management involvement at their agencies. Everyone was really pleased and felt that the commissioner support was a great way to set the tone in their agency, but then that needed to pass to upper-level managers to actually identify the resources, make sure it's the right person, make sure that their calendar can get cleared for their commitment to this, and to help navigate and manage that at a slightly different level in the organization. And there was also a request amongst this group to limit requests for in-kind help from their agencies to true subject matter expertise, and for the EQB to find some other way to find help for interagency projects that wasn't really subject matter expertise, like graphic design or editing or formatting or things like that that didn't have to come from a subject matter expert, but to find some other way to get that work done. So the recommendations that come from all these conversations and all these interviews are, first and foremost, conduct an annual work planning session. Will talked about it earlier in the meeting. I'm suggesting you use a 2-year window. Year one is going to be much more concrete and solid than year two. But if you look at it with that 2-year window, then you can see a little bit more what's on the horizon and it'll help you do better long-term planning as well. I'm also recommending that you adopt more consistent project management approaches, including the use of project charters to clarify roles and responsibilities and expectations about project management, to identify project sponsors at member agencies, and to create that shared vision and buy-in for how the project is executed, to use consistent work and communications plans that are widely communicated, and to have project closeout meetings, and then incorporate the learnings from those closeout meetings into future projects in the spirit of continuous improvement. I'm also recommending that you use the planning sessions to start identifying resources earlier in the planning process so that there is time to assess who in member agencies is going to be the right staff to contribute to these projects. And also related to that, consider both in-kind and financial contributions. I know budgets are strapped, but sometimes perhaps the most efficient and effective way to get the resources that are needed for projects is just to create some sort of resource pool, hire a temporary employee, hire a consultant, and it's a little bit cleaner than always using in-kind resources. And I'm also suggesting that a big piece of the issue here is communication. And the recommendation here is to build a constituency internal to state government, but also with external stakeholders, to build a constituency of folks who are invested in EQB work and should be kept informed about it on a quarterly basis. So, for instance, a short quarterly e-newsletter that is talking about projects that are underway, projects that are on the horizon, talking about project status, perhaps giving some short updates of EQB board meetings, but as a tool to really build that informed constituency, as a way to sort of facilitate informed partners on interagency work and to facilitate that resource identification. Another recommendation that you redefine and clarify the technical representative role. There is a whole lot of expertise among the technical representative group, as you well know, around environmental review. There is a pretty big environmental review work plan at the EQB right now, given recent legislation. So it seems logical that a priority for that group would be environmental review, given their knowledge. A recommendation is to begin involving key upper management at member agencies as a way to help identify resources for interagency projects and keep more people in the loop about the status of EQB projects. Also a recommendation to establish a board executive committee to really work with the EQB director on planning, to give the director sort of a sounding board to help think through some higher-level strategic issues before their board conversations, but to just really give, to create a group that's about 3 to 5 board members to have some of those preliminary conversations primarily as an aide to the director. And then I say this last recommendation with a little caution because I trial ran it with staff, EQB staff, and was reminded of just how resource-intensive these activities are. But also I'm recommending that you consider hosting future environmental congresses and updating the Environment and Energy Report Card as a way to engage public stakeholders and as a way to communicate critical cross-cutting environmental outcomes back to the public. I have been convinced of the intensity of the resources that takes to do on even a semi or biannual basis. So I'm also suggesting that those resources be clearly identified and allocated. They were very highly thought of in the interviews, both of these. And it does seem like one idea to address the desire to do more public engagement, and an idea that's been proven and works. So that is all of my recommendations on the project. I just want to say in closing, this was a fun project. So many assets to build on, so much potential here. You've got a really strong staff, highly engaged board, committed partners. Everybody's really on the same page. You've got a very compelling mission and ambitious agenda in front of you. There are plentiful assets and opportunities here. I think the critical thing is how do you prioritize amongst all of those opportunities to deploy the assets in the smartest way possible? And my suggestion is really enhance communications, develop more consistent processes to do that, and then engage in more regular and robust planning.
All right. Thank you very much. Lots of food for thought, and particularly the recommendations. I've gone through them earlier, and I think many of them I could absolutely say yes to. Some I would probably say no, and some maybe possible. I really appreciate the straightforward approach that you took when you went after this. Working with tech reps, Bob and I have a chance to chat pretty regularly on the work of the tech reps, and I appreciate that. So, questions or comments? Done.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask the citizen members for their reaction. Especially, I'm going to call out John and Julie, because and Eric, you've been on the board as citizen members for some period of time. I'm curious how the whole report strikes you, mostly because I want to hear that perspective before I go into agency speak.
I appreciate that also, and I think particularly, I think Julie and Eric, who preceded the balance of us on this board, have a good sense. And of course, John, Kristen, as well, Kate, all of the citizen members. So, Eric, you want to go first?
Well, sure. It was interesting to me to hear, I've been on the board, I believe this is wrapping up 6 years now, and two administrations, and it's a very different place in a lot of ways. Board members, staff, I don't believe there's one staff member that was from those olden days. I don't know how to say it, but it was interesting to read staff's perspective, tech reps' perspective, and to hear about, some of the, it sounds like potential breakdowns in communications, expectations. I understand they all have constraints and that sort of thing, but as far as who can authorize them to do the work, and I also recognize the commissioners, their job isn't to direct, staff there. So I guess these recommendations, I think, could be very helpful moving forward. I believe all of these recommendations could be very helpful moving forward. That's coming from a citizen's perspective. I don't have the constraints. It's an agency head kind of thing. But I guess I have a question for board members more than anyone is, now that we have this report, these recommendations, what do we do with this? Is there a plan to move forward for implementation? Or, I would hate to see this good work just kind of become a report, on a shelf somewhere and not go used. So I guess just kind of my thoughts.
Sure. I have a lot of ideas I really kind of want to hear your thoughts before presuming that I know best. I mean, part of me being able to do my job is I'm I'm managing more often than not far more resources than are actually accountable to me or in my budget. And so I really have to rely on my interagency partners to help me better understand the horizon of what's available. But certainly we have, I mean, there are a couple of things that I'll just jump to right away, and I'll pass these out, you know, because some of this is pretty straightforward operational stuff. And I thought it was just a really good idea for a little bit more consistency. Here are a couple. We drew this up, this project charter concept up, because we do, this is just something that we thought about after reading the report and as we've done some of our work, that, yeah, we do need a little bit more consistent project management approaches. All the projects are unique, but I think as a starting point, being able to get agreement from both the agencies that are participating and the board at large, it would be really helpful to have some sort of charter that's just agreed to on the front end that enables us to do our job as project managers, because there's a document that really spells it out, but also enables agencies to do their jobs, you know, because they're also wrestling for resources internally the same way that we're wrestling for resources externally. And so, you know, I think this is something that, you know, we're already ready to implement. You know, another concept that came out of this work is having an interagency sponsor. So, you know, one of our interagency projects, CZO project, we have functionally Deputy Commissioner Grant and Assistant Commissioner Thornton are serving as project sponsors. We get on a weekly call, and it really helps elevate the project when you go through periods where there's dead time and you need to, you know, and you don't need things from staff, and then, you know, 3 months later you do. Having a high-level sponsor involved in kind of breathing life back into it actually helps us considerably. And so, you know, as it relates to this environmental review charter in front of you, you know, we've talked with Commissioner Stein, you know, and he's volunteered to take on that responsibility for the environmental review project. But that's another approach that we're going to look to implement. Some of these are more short-term in nature, and some are more long-term. I think the ones, Eric, I mean, to your question about, you know, if we're going to have a plan, certainly, I think, though, we're already starting to move on some. You know, we are looking at schedules, because we do think January would be a good time to do a work planning session. You know, some of that will be scheduling dependent, and if we can't get enough board members there in January, we might have to, you know, bump it back a month or two. But that's something that I think before we can go and tick off a lot of this stuff, I think we should have a broader conversation about prioritization, because I think that's really tied closely to some of the operational stuff. You know, on one hand, you're trying to be more efficient with how you approach the work. On the other hand, you need to be better about how you prioritize the work. And if you can find that sweet spot, you know, I think we can really improve some outcomes. The other piece, though, that I do think is a short-term piece that we are, you know, we do want to have a conversation about is creating an executive committee so that we can vet some of these ideas, you know, with some board members prior to bringing them to the board, and try to build some support for it, so it's a little bit easier to get done when we bring it to the board and when we go to the agencies. And so those are kind of a smattering of things that either we're already doing or we're hoping to do very in the near term future. And the other things are a little bit more more long term, but certainly we don't see this as just report. I mean, when I look at the genesis of this, when I approached Kristen, it was very much, we've gone through a lot of evolution. Just, I mean, in my tenure, which has only been 2 years, but in this administration's tenure as a board, which is, you know, is over 4 years, and just generally when you look at the budget and everything else, there's been considerable evolution. And I thought it was a really good time to just kind of hit the pause button and get broad feedback on everything, you know. Gives us a chance to know, you know, how are we doing, and also, you know, express where we feel, you know, we can improve things with our member agencies and with just internally. And so we wanted to be kind of catch-all for a lot of ideas, and I do think Commissioner Fredrickson's right. I don't think every idea is necessarily ready for prime time, but I do think there's a lot of good stuff contained within all the recommendations that I think we're happy to kind of mine for next steps. So that's a long-winded answer. But really, I'm very interested in hearing the board's perspectives, too, so that I can embed that in any plan that we bring back.
Julie and John and Kate. Julie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pretty much what Eric said, we've been around longer than him, but we spent a lot of time the first several years we were on the board just trying to figure out what are we doing, are we going to survive, and Bob Patton knows that very well. We had several citizen mini-retreats trying to figure out what our role was, and now with this board, it's much more clear that the citizens do have a purpose on this board. And I just think the conclusions, they're very good, and I think Kristen did a good job with all the questions because she gave us an opportunity to, you know, say what we thought was good about it and what could use a little bit of work. And so I just think, yeah, that's good work. Thank you.
I have to agree with Julie in terms of the report. From the limitations of me as a citizen member, I think you nailed it. I think you did an excellent job. And just looking at the limited resources that the EQB has, I think this group has just done an outstanding job in the last 4 years that I've been on board. And I think at this point, though, in terms of the limited resources, we've kind of hit a wall. And in order to proceed, I think we're going to have to work on this strategic planning and prioritizations that I think Will is talking about right now. And that's what we need in order to move forward more efficiently and effectively.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a very useful to have these things spelled out, and I appreciated both being interviewed and now seeing the document. In terms of thinking as the role as a citizen member, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot and struggling with is, and I think this is an issue with the EQB overall. We have a key core staff, a relatively small, very capable, you know, sort of working above their weight, so to speak, punching above their weight, which is fantastic. But there's a lot of people involved who are involved, but not necessarily. It's not top priority number one because it's not their, you know, their first job. It's not. And as a citizen member, we have other roles and responsibilities in our lives, obviously. You know, as much as I would love to do EQB every day, it just isn't happening. And I think being aware of that and how to draw from the vitality of having people who are engaged in all sorts of different ways in state government and the community, and how to harness that energy in ways that feel that are productive both for the EQB and feel useful for the people who are taking the time to do this. I think that's something I've been thinking about a lot, and I don't have an answer. I have some ideas around it. And I think part of it is thinking about the role of the EQB. Sure, yes, we have the environmental review. We have the statutory things we have to do. And, you know, we have a new staff person, which is great. And we have increasing work on that. And anything else that sort of the legislature tells us to do, depending on the political cycles and what comes through. We saw this morning and we all raved about the convening capacity and power of this group. And that's, I think, sort of taking a temperature of what's in the state and sort of what Minnesotans are thinking. I think citizen members have a great role to play in that. I think it's particularly facilitated by effective staff work and led by commissioners and administration, people that helps to convene, you know, like when you have a lieutenant governor there, it helps draw people. And so that convening and sort of taking the temperature of the state. And then I less certain, and I'm curious about how the EQB can drive conversation in the state. That's not necessarily the role of state government, but it is talked about as one of the roles of the EQB as a place where we can drive leadership on environmental issues. So that idea of meeting our statutory requirements to make sure, like, things are working. Environmental review, we've got some big projects right now in the state that need to be done right and that people need to trust are being done right. And then we have this convening power that I think we are seeing seeing how useful that is, and hopefully that will continue. And then, you know, I think questioning, at least as a board, a citizen member, I'm kind of questioning how can we use this place as a way to help state government lead. So a couple details about the report. I think that coming out of, like, how do we get people committed to the EQB in a way that allows them to contribute and not feel like they're falling down on what they committed to, whether that's citizen members or tech reps or what have you. And I think the planning will really help, because we'll be all on the same page. I don't know much about tech rep work, so that, you know, some insight into that was useful to me as a board member. I don't know how much of that is my role as a board member. So those are some kind of overarching comments. Just again, I think this focusing on planning and realistic aspirational planning combined with realistic planning. I don't want sort of the being really realistic to hold us back at the beginning, but I think it's important to keep in mind.
Thanks, Kate. Kristen.
I would just really agree with everything the other citizen members said. I have long, being an old constituent of EQB as a citizen, I've long seen the importance of the public partnership. I've always seen that as a really central piece, and it's been always gratifying to hear the EQB support that, and this EQB has, you know, said how important public participation is. But what I love about this report is it really gives a new platform to create some policies and practices around actually people understanding more what that means, both members of the public and ourselves. And I like this. In the past, one of the frustrating things for me as a citizen has been that the EQB has sometimes taken the role of a referee. You know, whether it's, and it is one of the roles that EQB has, but I think that there is a potential in this ability to do some convening conversations and really recognizing and articulating our collective responsibility for the quality of Minnesota's environment. I think there's a way that will put the EQB in a position of more than referee, of really helping us to all together fulfill our mandates and missions. And so that's, and I want to say one quick thing about the tech rep, also as a citizen. The tech reps were really important to us because they were who we knew as citizens to go to for information. And I like this refreshing reviewing and looking at the tech rep responsibilities, and I really like the idea about them becoming more directly involved in the environmental review process, because that's a hard, you know, talk about a collaborative, collective project. You know, every environmental review is one of those. So anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to say something.
Other comments or questions from members? Oh, Brian.
Thank you, Kristen. It was a very good report. I do have a question. On a number of occasions, we've referred to the EQB, the board. This board was created by the legislature. I'm curious, did you ask any questions about the board? Did the legislature get it right out of the chute? Right makeup, right groups, right size, too many, too small? This agency's missing, this is not. Did you ask any questions along those lines with the makeup of the board?
Unfortunately, that was not in my scope. Great question, though.
Thank you.
We have to keep them employed, for goodness sakes. You can only have a set of time here.
Well, I just wanted to give the legislators kudos for getting it right the first time.
I think observation. I appreciate the report, and I was more interested in the tech rep interview findings, actually, than I was of the recommendation. And my sense is that maybe there's a feeling on the part of the tech reps that this is kind of a one-way street for them, and that it's all information going this way and nothing going back. And so, to use a football analogy, they are expected to be part of the team, but maybe are not allowed in the huddle as much as they'd like to be. And so you don't have to nod yes or no, but I sense that might be some of the issues that we need to focus on. And so maybe we just need to hug them a little more or something like that.
Well, I will
with their permission.
Yeah, with their permission.
I'm committed to doing that. Not the hugging part, I mean, but the engagement. Well, I don't want to get engaged to him either, but,
I like the two-way street analogy. Okay. My heart really went out to this group in these interviews because their role has changed significantly.
Of course, they're shameless for sucking up for something.
And they're incredible assets. The historical knowledge and the depth of their experience and knowledge with the EQB is considerable. I would strongly urge you to work with them to clarify that role as soon as possible.
That's easily done. I think the EQB is, to use your Kate, your line of punching above our weight. We have been for the last 4 years. We've taken on responsibilities that are way over our head at times, and we're doing it, and I think we're doing a really good job.
Absolutely.
Of it. And so there's nothing here that we couldn't fix with a little more money and a little more staff. I know that for a fact. And thus, we ask a lot of our agency partners. We're asking a lot of our tech reps. But I have one boss, and that's the governor. And the governor wants this done, and we all get it. And that's the direction we go. So I thank everyone for their commitment to help us punch above our weight. So you either get stronger or fatter, one of the two, right? I'm fixing to do the latter. That rhymes.
Tom.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving will put that in perspective.
And then you can go for a walk in the park.
Are you going like this because
no,
you're
I'm thinking.
Telling me to shut up and not say anything because it could go down fast?
It could.
Yeah, I know. This has happened before, right? Other comments, John?
Well, I thought Commissioner Landwehr had was trying to
just,
jump in.
Well, I think you've been hitting on some of those points just recently. I think it's hard to overstate the significance of the tech reps and the functioning of this group because as much as I know that the citizen members put in on their own, the commissioners don't spend a lot of time on the nuts and bolts of this, and we really rely on the tech reps. And we've also talked about, what does EQB do? And it's a forum for public discussion. It's environmental review, but it's also the sort of stuff that you saw this morning. It's setting the platform for, forward-looking, how do we look forward to issues and, looking at the water report and stuff like that. I don't know what proportion of all the work of EQB is actually environmental review anymore, but it's between 25% and 50%, I would guess, because it's other things as well. And so having a technical review group that can complement the staff component to do all those things is really critical. And so that does not necessarily mean they're all going to be competent in environmental review. They might be competent in planning or something else. And so I think we have to, perhaps the nugget that I got out of here, and Dave, I think your point is right, we're not going to sort of carte blanche take all these things, but I think the nugget that makes the most sense to me here is to sit down and think about what is the role of the tech rep as a resource to the staff and to the board, and how do they function within the agencies, how do they operate cross agencies, because I think one of the most valuable things is that cross agency work that goes on, and I know it goes on even though I don't necessarily get updates on how that's happening. So I just think that's really, really important, and we have to ensure that regular discussion among the tech reps is happening, and they're clear what they need to do, perhaps by virtue of that annual planning. So I think that is a very important component.
Good way to end. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been
Thank
really
you all.
Helpful.
Could I, Commissioner, here before we segue off of this, because I do think a couple things. One, as it relates to this executive committee question, I do think it would be really valuable if you're interested in serving in this capacity to let either the chair or myself know. I have a couple other kind of reflections as this is on my mind. I think it's broader than just what the role of the tech rep is, because I do think as we were kind of thinking about this, there was a void, and not a void based on lack of ability, but a void in how do you bridge a board member saying yes, we want to do this project, we can do it. And the technical staff that would participate in it, and how, and that's really what we're trying to get at
when we started this project was, how do we kind of set up this interagency infrastructure so when the board wants to do something, the resource, it's easier to get access to those resources and operationalize it a little bit quicker. And I think the infrastructure that we have right now, it doesn't happen as quickly as I think we could. And so we want to explore how we enhance that as we kind of think about redefining this tech rep role. And,
yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could just piggyback on that, I have a unique opportunity because Will and the staff work here in the building with us, and their budget and their personnel transactions, everything goes through our operation. And so I have more of a opportunity to see the how the machinery works and also how it doesn't work. And I think that is the key. What does not work is there's too much of a gap between the staff who do the work inside agencies and are contributors to these important projects and the leadership that sits at this table. And I think we actually have done our tech reps a bit of a disservice in terms of not building the necessary accountability through our ranks inside the agencies. So to me, that's not a citizen or member problem. That's an agency management problem. And we do not have a consistent way of addressing that. We've found the way to make it work more often than not. But I think the strain that you're experiencing in these comments is that tension, which is the staff of the agencies that come from their job from the day in, day out, my responsibility is, and they answer that question because they know what they were hired to do. And then a new idea finds its way into their life, and we then have to negotiate with a lot of people to manufacture that time to get something added or subtracted. And it's very, very difficult if we don't have a clearer structure for doing it. And I think Will and I have worked through this in numerous ways, just in terms of, you know, broadcasting meetings. So we had to figure that out. This is the PCA's machinery that sits here. Who's paying for that? Whose staff are doing that work? We have trained people. Should they be the ones doing that work? Do we want to train the EQB people to do that work? Those are the questions that regularly get sorted out. But I just want to, I think for the agencies at the table, that's one of the things we need to work through. How do we build a better service platform for our work here? Just like if I have a conversation with a legislator and I come home and I say, we got to get this information, it's due next Tuesday, I say that to a chain of command and it happens. We don't have a clear-cut way of doing this, that same thing for EQB projects. And that's, I think, what I heard in some of the tech rep frustrations is there's not a really good, clean, up-and-down, back-and-forth communication process.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, too, you know, one of the scabs that I kept trying to pick at, and despite all my lobbying of Kristen to put it in the report, it wasn't theirs. I think the infrastructure is there, quite frankly, of upper management to work on these issues. We have an energy and environment team made up of upper managers that meets on a quarterly basis. We have an interagency coordinating team on water that meets on a regular basis. So the structure for really diverting resources and making decisions and doing things on a timely basis is already there. And to the extent that we can continue to explore how we plug the work that we do with the tech reps on just kind of the monthly, getting ready for meetings, into that conversation so that when the board is ready to do things, we have an infrastructure that's ready to make it happen. That's something that, you know, I'm still going to continue to pursue because I do, part of this is also is, can we just be more efficient? I mean, I don't think we want to just create new interagency things that have a life of their own and then pull more resources when we're trying to find ways to kind of save resources. But, you know, another thing too I want to just note is, planning is critical, but there are limitations on an annual cycle with planning, and that is, you know, things like this climate meeting that we did this morning. I mean, this was we couldn't have forecast this a year out. I mean, this was a month ago, someone had a really good idea, and it was pretty much Anna and Paul, and we made it happen really quickly. And so we got to make sure, and I think the pipeline report was another one where it a year out, we wouldn't have been able to kind of pick at some of these issues. And however we do our planning, we want to make sure that we're giving ourselves enough bandwidth to do that kind of work. Otherwise, we're going to be working on issues that might be irrelevant or not timely. And so I think those are some other things that are kind of, we're kind of thinking about. And on a good note, though, I do think this report does a good job of really focusing on where we can improve things. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of really good things and really a lot of successes that we want to continue to celebrate, even though we are really very much committed to kind of continuous improvement and trying to fine-tune things. So thank you all for your consideration of this and the good conversation.
And we shouldn't forget that, you know, EQB today is an amalgamation of state planning and EQB, two agencies. Now
right.
We have one
that's
trying to do a little bit of both. So that's a tough situation to be in. Let's go then to Silica Sand update and welcome Eric. And you're going to lead off here. And also welcome to Jeff Hedman and Catherine Neuschler and Heather Ahrens.
We got a couple more, Jim Kelly and Teresa Haugen as well.
And Jim Kelly. He doesn't need to do well.
And while you're getting set up, kind of going back to our old planning conversation, this is one of those areas where it's actually highly successful. There was a legislative mandate. There were resources that followed it. And with it, it's very easy to then do our jobs. And so I think one of the things where I don't think there were any negative comments related to was related to silica sand coordination. And so if everything were that easy as getting an appropriation and a legislative charge, we wouldn't have to worry about this.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Today we'll be giving a brief update on silica sand activities.
Let me remind you.
I don't know if maybe it's just
hour.
Quiet. I'll be quick.
Full half an hour.
We'll be quick. First, we'll give an update on silica sand activities. Then we'll hear from Minnesota Department of Health on silica sand activities with the Department of Health. And then from PCA on water permitting and air monitoring as it relates to silica sand. And then we'll hear from the technical, we hear from the technical folks, we'll hear from EQB, DNR, PCA on the rulemakings. Okay, so to start with a silica sand update, just kind of a brief update on all things silica sand. While the state of Minnesota does not collect aggregated production numbers for silica sand facilities, the agencies do monitor the industry through environmental review notices, permit applications, contact with local regulating authorities, and published articles. From published articles, EQB has gleaned that the silica sand industry has slowed down in 2015. Low oil prices and reduced drilling in the shale regions of North Dakota are slowing the silica sand industry. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that oil prices fell to a benchmark low of $40 per barrel. And while U.S. output of oil has declined, production in other countries such as Saudi Arabia and Russia are keeping production high. In fact, some OPEC countries like Ecuador are operating at a loss. As a result, there is a glut of oil in the marketplace, which has impacted the production rates of non-traditional oil in regions of North Dakota, Texas, and Pennsylvania, where a lot of silica sand goes. As oil prices have fallen, so has the demand for energy production in the nation's shale industry. PacWest, a Houston engineering consultant division of IHS, published a report last month that predicts the U.S. frac sand supply would increase by 11% in 2015, while at the same time demand was expected to fall by 22%. Overall, PacWest has estimated that the U.S. frac sand market will shrink to $2 billion this year from $4.5 billion in 2014. Over in Wisconsin, in March, Chippewa Sand Transport announced plans to lay off 55 employees because of decreased demand for sand. Progressive Rail CEO has said that frac sand shipments on its Wisconsin Northern Railroad line in Chippewa Valley are down about 45% from last year. In Minnesota, a year ago, up to 58 oil trains, each with about 110 cars carrying 80,000 barrels of oil, traveled across Minnesota each week. In October, Minnesota officials said that figure dropped to about 47 a week. In Winona, Minnesota, the port in 2014 shipped 400,000 tons of sand. In 2015, thus far, the port has stopped shipping any sand altogether. Also in Winona, just this week on Monday night, the Winona City Council voted unanimously against requiring air quality monitoring at frac sand facilities in the city. Instead of requiring monitoring equipment, city leaders decided to focus on creating new dust management rules. And finally, EQB knows that that a few facilities are idled. Shakopee Sands facility in Scott County is currently idled, and two other facilities in Scott County that began the environmental review process, Merriam Junction and Minnesota Valley Sands, are both on hold in the environmental review process. I'm going to pass it to Jim.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I've appeared before the board previously on this subject. And I'm here today just to give you a brief update on MDH's recent activities and a little bit of a primer again on kind of why Silica posed the kind of questions it did when this issue first came up a couple of years ago. Primarily, the issues that were being brought to MDH's attention had to do with concerns around air quality related to silica sand mining, processing, handling, transportation, et cetera. Crystalline silica is a very common material. It's very common in our environment. And silica itself actually usually comes in two forms. The crystalline form, as it's mined at these facilities for use in the oil industry, and amorphous silica, which is really just glass. In fact, we're working with PCA right now on a facility just a few blocks from here where they're handling crushed glass for the recycling industry. But because it's amorphous silica, we really don't have the same kind of health concerns that we would if were it crystalline silica. So it's just an interesting dichotomy is that this industry is very old from that standpoint as well. So respirable crystalline silica is the main concern that we're concerned about when it comes to the handling of this material, especially the size that's 4 microns or smaller. So that's a very small size fraction. It's kind of an in-between size fraction when it comes to the regulation of particulate matter, which is typically based on either particulate sizes that are 10 microns or less or 2.5 microns or less. But with silica, that just happens to be the size fraction that we're concerned about from a human health standpoint. Crystalline silica has long been recognized as a hazard when it comes to occupational work, so occupational handling of this material. Known to cause disability and deaths who are workers in a number of industries that handle that material who are exposed over a very long period of time to typically very high levels of crystalline silica in the air. The good news is it's a problem that can be controlled. Dust control at these types of facilities is not a new technology. It's not a new issue. It's a common thing, and it can certainly be handled and accomplished fairly easily in most cases. So when it comes to the toxicity of silica, the concern is that silica can settle deep in the lungs if you're exposed to it, especially on a continual basis. It can even pass to other organs in the body through the blood if it's absorbed through the lungs. We do know that the risk of disease is related very closely to the level and intensity of exposure, so that's why it's such a concern in occupational settings. So the workers at these facilities, we remain potentially concerned about. They need to pay attention to the worker safeguards to reduce their exposures. But it also means that the risk to those who are exposed incidentally or to much lower concentrations or infrequently are at much, much less risk, and in fact, oftentimes at very little risk at all. Because it is such a recognized occupational hazard, however, that the OSHA, our Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, a long time ago has established occupational limits for exposure to this chemical or to this material in air, and their research arm, NIOSH, similarly proposed a level that's half, but still a relatively high level. If you adjusted those for 24-hour exposures, which is simply just doing a mathematical calculation to take it from 5 days a week to 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, you would develop numbers that are smaller, but correspondingly we would think would correspond in the way that we look at the occupational numbers to a level of disease that perhaps would be more than we'd want to see in the general population. And that was part of our thinking as we looked at this potential for exposure on the part of the population. So that was really the concerns that were being brought to the department in 2012 and 2013 as this industry appeared to be taking off here in Minnesota. The concern that non-workers, community residents near these facilities could be exposed. We do know from studies of the literature, and these are cases that took place in other parts of the world, not here in Minnesota certainly, and not even in the United States, that ambient crystalline silica levels could be elevated downwind of some of these facilities if they were not employing effective dust control measures. So again, that's something we typically see here in Minnesota or in the country. And silicosis even has been reported. That's the disease that's associated with long-term silica exposure in some of these exposed individuals in non-occupational settings. So that was all the background as to why the Department of Health was requested in the legislation from 2013 to develop protective health-based value for crystalline silica in air that could be used to evaluate facilities, evaluate air testing done near these facilities in order to determine if they could pose a risk to the communities. So we developed that value after carefully reviewing all the toxicological information and other information we could find about that and arrived at a chronic health-based value, so a value that's designed to be protective for exposure 7 days a week, 365 days a year over a lifetime of 3 micrograms per cubic meter. So we consider that a very protective value, especially as compared to the occupational numbers I showed you a little bit earlier. It's protective against silicosis and also against the incidence of lung cancer, which can be elevated when one's exposed to other types of particulates as well, in addition to smoke and other types of chemicals. So we feel that that level is protective to the general population. And current air monitoring that you hear a little bit about, conducted here in Minnesota and nearby, suggests that levels that are found are below this chronic health-based value near these facilities. So much reassurance there. So just briefly, I'm also going to touch on some of the water quality concerns that the department has expressed over time when it comes to these facilities. All mines pose some potential risk to water quality, and that's because there's some removal or reduction typically of cover, protective cover material that can sit above the aquifers. There are chemicals used within the mining process, fuels, other automotive liquids, explosives and minerals, processing chemicals, and flocculants that have been used in these facilities to settle mine or fine materials. There could be runoff that could enter the mine, whether it's bacteria or viruses from improper waste handling. Pesticides and nutrients from nearby farm fields. We know some of these facilities are near agricultural facilities where there could be other materials that we might be concerned about. And there are other contaminants as well. Illegal waste disposal, that's not typically something that occurs at an active mining operation, but I've been around my share of waste disposal sites that took place in abandoned gravel pits and so forth that caused significant groundwater problems. And this is often a result of incomplete reclamation and poor planning in terms of future land use. That's when the problems occur. I want to stress that the active mining operations are not causes of groundwater contamination. It's when other activities that take place nearby sometimes result in issues that we need to be concerned about. But because groundwater is very difficult to clean up once it's been contaminated, the focus needs to be on prevention up front, which is why we've highlighted some of these concerns. As a result, we've looked at several of the commercial flocculants and added them to our contaminants of emerging concern list. We developed health-based value for acrylamide, which is one of the common flocculants that we know has been used in this industry, actually polyacrylamide, but the concern is it can break down into acrylamide, which is much more toxic. Our public health laboratory has been working with our fellow agencies on developing analytical methods for some of these contaminants in groundwater that could be brought to bear if there's a situation of concern. And we also participate in environmental review activities with our fellow agencies, as well as assisting local communities with questions on silica sand from a health standpoint, and participating, obviously, in the interagency silica sand assistance team. So that's basically a highlight of what MDH has been up to for the last year to year and a half with regards to silica sand. And with that, if you don't have any questions, I'll turn it over to one of my colleagues to carry on this conversation.
Maybe we'll just kind of go directly through the presentation, and then if there are hold questions till the end, if that's all right with balance. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Teresa Haugen with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm here just to give you a brief update on silica sand and water permitting. At the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, we issue NPDS, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, State Disposal System, so NPDS-SDS permits to industrial facilities, including silica sand facilities, so mines, processing plants, transload facilities. These permits cover or permit wastewater and stormwater discharges associated with silica sand mining facilities. And this slide here illustrates the permitting trend over the last 5 years with the NPDS permits. As you can see, indicated by the blue bars, the number of permits issued in Minnesota to silica sand operations has dropped off in recent years. Prior to 2011, there were 6 existing permitted silica sand facilities and 3 new permitted facilities, so for a total of 9 in 2011. There were 6 new permitted facilities in 2012, which brought it to 15 total permitted facilities in Minnesota. In 2013 and 2014, there were 3 new permitted facilities each year as well, so 18 and then 21. And then as of today, in 2015, we have not had any permitted applications received or permits issued for silica sand facilities in Minnesota. So although there have not been any permitting activities this year, facilities that have been previously permitted in Minnesota for silica sand sites have received coverage under our MNG 49 non-metallic mining associated activities permit. This is a general permit, meaning it's an umbrella-like permit, which is issued to multiple facilities that have similar operations and similar discharges. And this is a permit that covers both the stormwater and wastewater discharges. This permit expires October 31st of next year, so in a little less than a year away. And we're currently working on the rewrite of this permit and looking at how to cover silica sand activities under this permit moving forward. Do we allow the coverage? If so, how are they covered? Once the permit is drafted, it'll be put on public notice in which members of the public can view the draft permit, comment on it. After that process is complete, all the comments will be addressed and the permit will be final issued, and then all eligible facilities will have reapplied and received coverage at that time. And this permit is rewritten and expired every 5 years. And that is all I had.
Thank you very much, Heather. Teresa, I'm sorry. Heather, are you going to be talking? You are. Okay, so you're just waiting in the wings. And Catherine? Okay. Eric?
Now we're Jeff.
Chair, board members, again, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Hedman. I've been working closely with the air quality related issues. Again, I work for the Pollution Control Agency in the air quality permits section. Today, I'll be giving you a very brief overview of the activities that occurred here in Minnesota as they pertain to air monitoring, along with a very short selected highlights of activities that have happened outside the state. And then I'll conclude with some of the observations that we've seen so far. So in this state, we've passed and we have gotten data from 3 different facilities, fence line data from 3 different facilities, meaning that there are monitors, ambient air monitors, posted at the fence line of those facilities. And those monitors have collected data about several different pollutants. They're all collecting data about a particular class of pollutants called particulate matter, but it's subdivided into various size fractions of interest. The ones we've been collecting are documented here, TSP, also known as total suspended particulate, size fraction called PM10, PM25, and then also the size fraction that Jim mentioned earlier that is that we're looking at closely for silica called PM4 silica. We also conducted a monitoring operation in the town of Winona, southeast Minnesota, and simultaneously operated monitors in a southeast Minnesota location near the town of Stanford that acted as a reference site. We've also observed data and heard about data from other locations. Specifically, there's an institutional researcher out of Wisconsin, I believe Eau Claire, that is using some unorthodox methods to try to obtain similar types of data and has published their work recently. His conclusions are that he recommends further research and monitoring for PM2.5, believing that if that particular pollutant will be monitored for, then that may also be protected for silica without the need to directly measure silica. There have been a group of consultants also operating with some facilities in Wisconsin. Their conclusion, or rather their work, was largely focused around obtaining PM4 silica data. As I mentioned earlier, we're also doing it in Minnesota. Their results largely agree with what we're seeing in the state so far. And as I'll point out on the next slide, the values that have been observed have not been above Minnesota's Department of Health's value that they have provided for us, meaning favorable results so far. There have been other states that have been also interested in this particular issue. One of the states that has contacted us somewhat recently is Pennsylvania. They have a site, they have a number of sites actually, but at least one site where they conduct transload operations, which is where they move sand from one mode of transportation to another, and they were interested in doing some fence line monitoring around that particular site. So Pennsylvania contacted us to learn more about some of our methods and the way we've been approaching that particular issue. I've just recently learned that that particular business operation will no longer go forward, but they nevertheless collected some initial data from the site that was proposed. Pennsylvania will write up a short report about that in the near future. And finally, the federal government is also interested in this particular issue. One of the federal agencies, ATSDR, Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, is particularly interested in silica. There's a number of sites located across the nation where they have some particular concerns, and they have contacted us about our approach for obtaining silica data and are likely to use it going forward. In addition, the EPA itself is also has an initiative called the Next Generation Compliance Initiative, which focuses in part around using more fence line monitoring than they have before. So they have contacted us in that regard. I'll conclude by giving you, again, a very brief summary of what we've seen as far as the actual data is concerned here in Minnesota. So there have been growing and increased interest across both state level consultants and industry and citizens and community members about obtaining this type of data just as time has progressed. As far as the results go, so far our measured PM10 and PM2.5 results have not exceeded ambient standards, which again is a good thing. I can say the same for the PM4 silica measured values. Again, they are not above the Department of Health's PM4 silica value of 3 micrograms per cubic meter. But the story is somewhat different for this other pollutant that I mentioned in one of my initial slides, TSP. We do actually have monitored exceedances and actually a violation in 2014 of this particular pollutant. Again, I want to emphasize that this is not specific to silica. It represents particles that can be suspended, any particle of any chemical composition. And the standard that was violated was a standard that is intended to protect not human health, but rather public welfare in this particular instance. So we had a pair of exceedances in 2014, which was sufficient to cause violation, and a separate pair of exceedances in 2015 that occurred across two different monitors, which in this instance is not enough to actually cause a violation, but we are close. Agency is actively and aggressively looking into why this occurred and what we can do to ensure that the area is restored to its previous air quality.
Great. Questions from the board for Jim or Jeff or Teresa or Eric?
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Could you just clarify? You just said the TSP measurements were not damaging to human health but public welfare. Is that what, just itchy eyes or something?
Jeff?
Sure, board members. There are actually a pair of standards. There's a primary and a secondary ambient standard. Primary standards are designed to protect against human health. And I want to emphasize that the values we have seen have not exceeded the primary standards, meaning that human health is not adversely affected in this particular instance. The standard we are speaking to, again, is the secondary standards, which are, again, referred to as secondary standards. And if you'll indulge me for a moment. Secondary ambient air quality standards are levels established to protect public welfare from known or anticipated adverse effects such as injury to agricultural crops and livestock, damage to or deterioration of property, annoyance and nuisance of persons, or hazards to air or ground transportation. So not itchy eyes in this instance.
Do we know which category this particular exceedance fit into? Of those named categories?
It's an effect that can influence those particular activities. So we can see adverse effects for transportation in that area where we're seeing those monitored values. And it can lead to infrastructure degradation.
Mr. Chair, but I think, Brian, to your question, those are examples in the secondary standard. They're really not like you have a secondary standard that protects for transportation. You have a secondary standard that protects for crops. It's the standard is protective of all those things. That's so we don't know, to be honest, to say it could affect crops, it could affect transportation, it could affect all those other things, but that's what the exceedance involves. So I wouldn't want to hazard a guess to say which it was, but you do hear frequent complaints from communities when you have that exceedance of TSP about dust on the road, for example, dust on their windowsills, things like that that are more of a nuisance to your way of life than and risk to public welfare, you know. So it's not a health driven, not as much a human health driven issue.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for, is an example of what that, use the word public welfare, and I thought if it had an impact on crops, it would certainly have an impact on people.
Yeah. Other questions, Eric?
I have a question on the time frame, and maybe I missed it, for the air monitoring. Was that done in 2015? When start and end date, kind of?
Chair, board member, the monitoring that has occurred in presumably Minnesota was your question.
Yes.
Initially originated approximately 2012, depending on the specific site, spanned between 1 and 3 years, depending on, again, exactly what area. And in Winona specifically, it was a year-long project. One of our initial sites, Shakopee Sands, was to conduct monitoring for approximately 3 years, and they actually went a bit beyond that. Another site, Tiller North Branch, and now it does business under another name, was originally slated to do 2 years. They voluntarily agreed to do a bit more. They actually just ceased the other day. And there's a third site in Minnesota still actively conducting monitoring. It's the most recent of the three I've mentioned. And they have conducted monitoring for a bit over a year now.
Okay. Just have a follow-up that. Just as, you know, we saw Eric's slide or discussion about demand decreasing, and I guess I'm just trying to gauge. We haven't seen any exceedances, but I'm wondering at what capacity these mines were operating at. You know, if there's a decreased demand and if they're only operating at 20% capacity, we may not be getting a good read on if they were, you know, going 100% out. It's just...
Chair, board member, that's a fair question. I would characterize the bulk of the monitoring occurring prior to the end of calendar year 2014. It's my understanding that the price of oil started to lower in the fall of 2014, which would, if the price of oil is somehow linked to the price of sand and thus its demand, then I would surmise that approximately half would occur prior to that, the downturn in the industry across this particular state. So some of the data we have obtained is in its heyday, so to speak, and some of it has occurred during the downturn.
Okay, so we do have a snapshot, at least full capacity type operations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you to each and every one. Eric, we'll just
all right,
dismiss the Teresa and Jeff and Jim and ask Catherine and Heather to come up.
All right, thank
please.
You. Now we'll give a brief update on rules from each of the agencies. Catherine and Heather, thanks for joining. As you know, during the 2013 legislative session, three agencies were directed to make rules for the regulation of silica sand projects. All three agencies presented to the board in April of this year, and we're back to give an update. As for EQB, during the 2015 special legislative session, the interim EQB threshold was extended indefinitely. You can see the language on the screen here that what was changed. As a reminder, the EQB thresholds are all projects 20 acres or more. The LGU is the RGU for an EAW, and all projects that store 7,500 tons or more or have a throughput of 200,000 tons, the PCA is the RGU for an EAW. And EQB continues to work on the rule language and definitions with member agencies, taking into account comments from the Silica Sand Rule Advisory Panel and other available data. EQB submitted the rules to the revisor and is working through language and shared definitions and sonar development. And EQB expects to move forward on the rule in the upcoming months with comparable timelines to the MPCA and DNR.
Heather, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Heather Ahrens. I am with the DNR, Silica Sand Rulemaking Coordinator. Back in April of this year, the DNR, along with MPCA and EQB, presented a silica sand rulemaking update. And at that time, he spoke to concluding a year-long multi-agency advisory panel that generated very significant and valuable input, and then that we were moving into a quieter phase, both on the rule and in writing into the sonar. So as of today, the DNR is still in this general quiet phase, but we've been making progress to get to the next step of rule development, which is to notice with the intent to adopt in a formal comment period. Some of the benchmarks that the DNR has achieved in the last 6-7 months is integrating that, you know, a lot of written and oral comments from the panel, as well as conducting internal agency review. Once the draft was fully assembled of the rule, we did an internal legal review and then submitted it to the reviser in August. We got reviser comments back in the end of September, and they provided, you know, some additional issues and comments that we have since worked through. We're also continuing, as Eric said, agency collaboration on overlapping issues. There have been changes to the rules since it has been that we've released it, the last draft. As Eric reported, we're witnessing a downturn of the market. In the previous version of the rule, I had specified a contingency reclamation plan for temporary shutdowns as an optional requirement of the reclamation plan, but I'm making it a requirement so that, you know, all reclamation plans have to address the possibility of a temporary shutdown. Other examples include that we're, instead of writing blasting language, we're looking to reference the National Fire Protection Association Explosive Material Code, Chapter 11. This is quite frequently referenced by other agencies, such as the State Fire Marshal, for other fire-related topics, Department of Public Safety. You'll see significant improvement in the rules, readability, and understandability, as well as organization. And it has incorporated a lot of plain language guidelines. And then during the process of the reviser changes and comments, legal staff looked closely to make sure that the language was, A, within the scope of our rulemaking authority and wasn't duplicative of existing laws. So in my initial published draft that I had sent out earlier in April of this year, there were, for example, rules about noticing public meetings. Well, that's very well covered in Minnesota Statute 13D. So just to make sure that it's not duplicative or potentially competing with existing, you know, statutes, we're removing some language as well. So next steps include for us is to submit another draft to the reviser that will incorporate the changes and responses to their question. And once the reviser goes through that, or once we get to that iteration, the DNR is interested in posting a preliminary draft rule language once more on our Silica Sand website just before we post for a notice to adopt. It's our goal to avoid any surprises, especially for the panel members who provide so much of their time and energy and input, as well as other stakeholders. Once this preliminary draft is posted, I'll continue on the sonar development and moving on to the next phase, which is notice to the intent to adopt.
Thank you, Heather. Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. I'm Catherine Neuschler. I'm the supervisor of the rules unit at the Pollution Control Agency, and I'm working on our silica sand rule along with Jeff Hedman, who was here earlier, who's our technical expert, and Nathan Cooley, who's our rules coordinator. I think Heather's statement about a quiet phase is very apt. We're in a similar place. We're continuing to work on our silica sand rule. As currently sort of envisioned, the rule talks about permitting, who needs a permit, who doesn't, standards and practices that facilities need to undertake, and monitoring. And I think, Board Member Tomlinson, your question about capacity and monitoring is something that we're wrestling with as we think about the rule. And we're also looking at very closely at all the data that Jeff mentioned in his report about the monitoring data that we've received to make sure that our rule would really be effective at controlling particles. So we're doing all of that, and in addition, we're working very hard to make sure the rule is as clear and easy to implement as possible. We want it to be very clear about who's in and who's out and what they have to do. We don't want anyone to get in trouble because they can't tell if the rule applies to them or what parts apply to them. And as part of that, you know, we want to be very consistent with the EQB and the DNR rules wherever we need to be. I think, as Will noted earlier, this has been a very collaborative process with mandates going out to three agencies. We've all been talking a lot and talking about definitions and where do we need to have our rules sort of line up to make things easier to understand for the regulated parties. We are also working with our legal team and the reviser on the PCA's rule on what I think is often the most difficult part of rulemaking, which is turning a common sense idea that sort of makes sense to everybody into actual clear, unambiguous rule language that isn't going to wind you up in court so that everybody understands it. The reviser has some good feedback for us on our initial draft, and so we're just going back and looking and trying to make sure we're not being too vague or too broad. Our plan is to release another informal draft for public review. We released one to the advisory panel last November, so our hope is to release another informal draft before the end of this year, and that would be something that would reflect some of this wrestling with these questions that we've done while we've tried to hold in our minds the very valuable input that we did get from our advisory panel. And then as Heather stated, sort of as that part goes out, move fully into writing the statement of need and reasonableness that really lays out the decisions that we've made, and move eventually to notice of intent to adopt rules.
Thank you. Questions for the panelists? Seeing none. Eric?
Thank you, Mr.
Closing
Chair.
Comments?
I just wanted to remind the board and anyone watching or anyone in the audience, there's a lot of information available on the EQB website, on each agency's website, and there's a handout over on the table. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think we're at a point where a motion to adjourn would be in order. There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. We stand in adjournment.
Excellent use of the gavel, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One crack is enough.
Are you going out this weekend?
You betcha.
Where?
We're up in the Bruno area. You know where it is?
And, I like to be all day.
So last week,
yeah,
we're,
I know.
Remember, Brian?
No, it's dropping in. No, this
I'm
week.
Just going to say it's 9 o'clock.
Have you said that?
It's a couple pieces of private land. Yeah, it's an 80-acre piece of a friend of a friend has. A 40-acre piece that a brother of a friend has.
I know, and
that 40-acre piece is kind of embedded in some public land, too. So. You go out?
No. So I have. You
too. I coming to these?
You can't grow up in Grand Rapids without going out.
That's all you
have. Sometime in history, right?
Yeah. I shot a deer. My one deer. That was my coming of age when I was 53 years old.
It's been a long time since I got a deer, so I'm in pressure here, you know.
Steve.
Yeah, I got a meeting at 5, so.
Well, the good news is I can always commiserate with the whiners who didn't get a deer, because I didn't get one either. Sandy, how are you?
And maybe you're better off in that group there.
That's right, yeah. If I devote it, oh, I got a 20-point buck. The only thing is, well, sure.
He had an area there.
Yeah, yeah, he probably got a special permit. He probably, had, you know, well, some guy who owes him money or whatever.
I trust him. If nobody else does.